Imagine walking into a beautiful historic house. You know, from the outside, the architecture is just striking.
Right, the paint is fresh, the windows are perfectly aligned.
Everything looks to be in impeccable order. But when you step inside and you set a marble on the kitchen floor, it immediately rolls right into the corner.
Oh, I see. So the structure looks entirely sound, but
But the foundation beneath it is shifting. It's this slow, almost imperceptible settling that alters the fundamental way everything inside that house actually operates.
and the danger with a shifting foundation is that you rarely notice the movement while it's actually happening. I mean, you only notice the consequences later. You get doors that refuse to close, or cracks spiderwebbing up the drywall. The house is still standing, but the geometry that holds it together is just compromised.
Well, today we are doing a deep dive into a source that argues our entire societal house is built on a foundation that is rapidly giving way. We are looking at a Sunday sermon delivered on March 15th, 2026.
Delivered by Brother Steve at New Life Benson. Right.
Exactly. It's actually lesson 60 in his extensive series on the Sermon on the Mount. And this specific message zeroes in on Matthew 5.1 time, operating under the theme Christ and the Law.
Fascinating topic.
It really is. Now, before we proceed, it is critically important to establish a clear framework for you as you listen today. This source material contains heavily politically charged commentary regarding modern society, morality, and government.
And it is delivered strictly from a conservative Christian perspective.
Right. So we need to make it abundantly clear that our objective here is not to take sides. We are not endorsing or validating the viewpoints expressed.
Absolutely not.
Our role is strictly to observe and impartially report on the architecture of his argument, so you can fully understand the rhetorical and theological strategies at play.
And Brother Steve's primary objective in this message is really to instruct his congregation on how to navigate what he perceives as a dark, degrading world.
But he doesn't start his theological argument by just opening the Bible, does he?
No, he doesn't. He actually starts with a diagnosis of modern cultural history. He points directly to the 1960s as the true catalyst for this current foundational shift.
He identifies that cultural mantra of do your own thing, which obviously originated in the 60s and carried through all the subsequent decades. To him, that is the exact moment things began to fracture.
Right, because to Scave, this wasn't just some cultural trend involving, music or fashion. He believes it birthed the prevailing spirit of what he terms antinomianism.
Antinomianism. So let's break that down for the listener.
Well, understanding that specific theological term is essential to understanding his entire worldview. So anti meaning against, and nomos meaning law.
Ah, so it's fundamentally an anti-law attitude.
Exactly. Steve's central thesis is that modern society has fatally equated the concept of freedom with individual self-expression.
While in his theological framework, true freedom is found only in divine obedience, so doing your own thing is the exact philosophical opposite of submitting to a higher objective authority.
Right. And he traces the real-world impact of that antinomian mindset directly to how people function today. He describes it as a form of personal existentialism.
Meaning that if there is no ultimate law, then the only thing that matters is the immediate present.
Precisely. People are living strictly for the moment. They're grabbing whatever pleasure or advantage they can right now, completely unmoored from any concern for future consequences or, well, eternal judgments.
He actually links this modern existentialism to a specific era in biblical history, finding a parallel in the book of Judges. He frequently quotes the scripture stating, "Everyone did what was right in their own eyes."
And the mechanism behind that biblical societal collapse was the absence of a king.
Right.
Steve interprets this as a society operating without any recognized representative of God. So he uses this ancient text to paint a picture of our current society adrift in moral relativism.
Where the individual ego has usurped the role of the ultimate authority on what is right and wrong. And to ground this philosophical critique in reality, Steve presents several highly specific, politically charged examples from the secular world.
He does. He points to a culture of lawlessness that he claims is actively fueled by professional protesters.
This astounding phrase, professional protesters. He asserts these individuals are making $60,000 to $80,000 a year.
And he attributes their funding to billionaires like George Soros, as well as an unnamed American living in China.
The rhetorical mechanism he's employing there is really significant to note. He is not framing societal unrest as organic civic disagreement or, just a natural byproduct of a diverse populace.
Now, by labeling protesters as professional, and funded by shadow figures, he is framing the unrest as a deliberate, financed dismantling of divine order.
It reinforces his antinomian thesis. To him, this isn't just politics. It is an organized rebellion against law itself.
Exactly. And he builds on this by lamenting what he sees as the government's complete abandonment of Judeo-Christian morality.
The evidence he lists is quite striking. He includes the widespread cultural acceptance of homosexuality, the medical facilitation of surgical sex changes for children under 10, and a justice system that he claims frequently releases criminals who commit what are termed victimless crimes.
Right. And he expresses profound disbelief at the very concept of a victimless crime.
Which is fascinating. Why is that concept so impossible for him to accept?
Well, his disbelief stems from his incredibly rigid definition of law. In an antinomian society, a crime is only a crime if it visibly harms another human being, hence, victimless.
I see.
But in Steve's paradigm, every moral infraction is a direct offense against God's law. Therefore, a victimless crime is an absolute absurdity to him.
The government's refusal to legislate morality based on divine law is, to him, the ultimate symptom of institutional decay. He actually uses a compelling scientific analogy from the pulpit to explain the mechanics of this decay.
He does. He literally compares the societal trajectory to the second law of thermodynamics.
Entropy.
Exactly. Entropy. The principle that any closed system will naturally move from a state of order to a state of disorder unless outside energy is applied.
Right. Just as energy inevitably degrades, Save argues that human morality naturally degrades when left to its own devices. And he emphasizes that this is no longer a slow, gradual burn.
No, he claims this process of moral entropy has visibly and drastically accelerated over the past 20 years.
The marble isn't just rolling into the corner anymore. The floorboards are actively snapping.
That's a great way to put it. Now, if the secular world is operating as a closed system experiencing rapid moral entropy, you would expect Steve to position the church as the ultimate sanctuary, right?
As the outside energy holding the system together.
Exactly. But his most passionate grievance in this sermon is his belief that the church is succumbing to the exact same disease.
He forcefully argues that instead of the church acting as an unyielding force changing the culture is successfully changing the church.
And to understand the depth of his frustration, we have to look at the global context he provides early in the message.
Right. He mentions having just returned from a massive shepherds' conference in California, an event gathering 5,000 pastors from 67 different countries.
He briefly notes the absence of the late John MacArthur at this gathering, but the sheer international scope of the event clearly gave him a new lens through which to view his local reality.
He explicitly contrasts the reality of pastors from places like Iran with the reality of the American church. And the contrast is stark.
Incredible, really.
He describes Iranian pastors as men who literally fear for their lives, their families, and their freedom simply for practicing their faith.
And when he holds that image of perilous obedience up against the American church, he sees a domestic institution that has become dangerously soft.
Overly comfortable.
Overly comfortable and heavily infiltrated by the very antinomian immorality he condemned in the secular world.
That word, infiltrated, carries heavy implications. It implies that the moral decay didn't just passively seep through the walls.
Right, is actively permitted through the front doors by negligent leadership.
And the examples he shares to illustrate this infiltration are clearly designed to shock his congregation out of their complacency. He recounts reading an article about a church where the elders were actively swapping wives.
Astounding.
Yeah.
But the true scandal, in Steve's eyes, was that the church leadership consciously decided to do nothing about it.
Paralyzed by the fear of losing attendance and causing a rift.
Exactly. And he brings this critique even closer to home by pointing out the presence of LGBTQ plus preachers, specifically noting that there is, quote, one in Benson.
He is forcing his congregation to recognize that the entropy isn't just a national news story. It is operating right in their own zip code.
But what requires careful analysis here is the theological logic Steve identifies as the root cause of this church infiltration. He doesn't just blame secular culture.
No, he targets a false theological paradigm being taught from pulpits that enables this behavior. He sharply criticizes the concept that grace functions as a free pass for ongoing moral failure.
He specifically dismantles what he refers to as a two-parts theory, which he notes is being taught by a prominent church in California.
So tell us about this two-parts theory.
Well, the two-parts theory is essentially a psychological and theological loophole. It posits that a Christian is divided into two distinct entities, a new creature saved by grace, and an old man bound by sinful nature.
I see. So under this paradigm, if a person engages in immoral behavior, they can conveniently attribute the sin entirely to the old man.
Exactly. It creates a firewall against personal accountability.
Okay.
It allows someone to engage in severe moral compromise while maintaining their spiritual self-esteem.
As Steve bluntly puts it, it allows you to still be a rotten stinker and be happy with yourself.
Right. And consider the underlying anxiety driving this portion of his sermon. I mean, he is delivering this passionate critique to his own congregation,
which suggests a profound concern that the people sitting in his own pews are quietly searching for, or maybe already utilizing, these exact same loopholes.
The urgency in his voice indicates he views this not as an abstract theological debate, but as an active, present threat to the people in the room.
It's analogous to an individual having massive, insurmountable financial debts completely forgiven. But instead of walking out of the casino, changing their lifestyle, and living responsibly,
they view the debt forgiveness as a limitless, revolving line of credit.
Exactly. They use the grace of forgiveness as a license to sit right back down at the blackjack table and keep gambling. Steve is standing at the doors of the casino, demanding that they walk away from the tables entirely.
And having diagnosed the antinomian disease ravaging both the secular society and the modern church, Steve finally pivots to provide the anchor.
He turns to the historical text of Matthew 5.19 to establish what he calls the pertinence, the absolute unyielding importance of biblical law.
To understand why he uses this specific text as the cure, we really have to look at how Steve explains the historical audience Jesus was originally addressing.
Right. Steve provides vital context regarding the expectations placed on Jesus at the time. The Jewish people of the first century were living under Roman occupation.
And they were largely anticipating the arrival of a political king, a Messiah who would violently overthrow the Romans and establish a powerful external geopolitical kingdom.
They wanted a change in government.
Exactly. But Steve emphasizes that Jesus bypassed the political and offered something radically different, an internal kingdom.
He was not introducing a new legislative system for the state. He was demanding a fundamental transformation of human character.
And that requires an internal shift in allegiance, not just outward, a performative compliance with religious traditions.
Which brings us to the core mechanism embedded in Matthew 5.19. It establishes a strict, uncompromising hierarchy based entirely on obedience to the law.
The mechanism is binary and stark. Jesus states that whoever breaks the least of these commandments and teaches others to do the same will be called the least in the kingdom of heaven.
Conversely, whoever keeps them and teaches them will be called great.
It is a direct refutation of the antinomian spirit. In this framework, greatness is not achieved through self-expression or finding clever theological loopholes like the two parts theory.
Greatness is intrinsically linked to adherence to the law. And this is where Steve deploys a truly fascinating linguistic detail that gives his entire argument its sharpest, most effective edge.
He takes the congregation directly into the original Greek text. He focuses specifically on the word translated in English as break, as in breaking the least of the commandments.
He explains that the original Greek word used is luo.
And the translation of luo is highly revealing. It fundamentally means to loose, to untie, or to let go.
The imagery here is vital. It is not necessarily describing an act of aggressive, violent rebellion where someone takes a hammer and actively shatters a rule.
No, it describes an act of careless dropping. It is a slow loosening of the grip.
And to make this abstract ancient Greek concept resonate with a modern audience, Steve grounds it in a highly relatable personal anecdote. He recounts a time years ago when he was managing a Greek cashier at a retail job. At the end of the night, when the cash register would inevitably come up short, Steve would confront the cashier and ask what happened to the missing money.
And what did the cashier say?
The cashier would simply shrug his shoulders and say, "Let it." According to Steve, that phrase meant, "The money is gone, it is lost, and I simply do not care enough to worry about it."
It is the absolute embodiment of apathy.
It is an incredible rhetorical maneuver. Steve uses that exact attitude of retail apathy to indict the modern Christian.
He warns his congregation that they're treating God's divine law with the exact same careless disregard as that cashier treated the short cash drawer.
They're loosening their grip, dropping the moral standards, and shrugging their shoulders with a spiritual lacush. They simply do not care enough to maintain the rigorous standard required of them.
By connecting the ancient Greek root of luo to a modern, mundane attitude of workplace apathy, Steve sets a brilliant psychological trap for his audience.
He forces them to internalize the critique.
Exactly. They might not view themselves as violent rebels actively destroying society, but he forces them to ask, am I carelessly dropping the standards? Am I treating divine obedience with an attitude of lit?
It reframes everyday compromise as a direct violation of Matthew 5.19.
So as we synthesize all these elements, the overarching message of Brother Steve's sermon becomes remarkably clear. He is not offering gentle pastoral suggestions or comfortable life advice.
Not at all. He is demanding complete, uncompromising obedience to biblical law as the singular defense against a degrading world.
He explicitly warns his listeners against the danger of building custom paradigms.
And he defines a paradigm as a window through which we view life, shaped entirely by our own subjective desires, past experiences, and cultural conditioning.
He cautions them not to construct customized theological windows that serve no other purpose than to excuse their favorite, most comfortable fins.
So, why does analyzing a local sermon from 2026 matter to you, the listener? Well, it matters because it offers a profound, unvarnished look into the specific rhetorical and theological strategies that conservative religious leaders are currently deploying.
It illuminates how they interpret the chaos of the modern world and how they are instructing their communities to respond.
It demonstrates exactly how these leaders attempt to anchor their congregations against what they perceive as the sweeping, chaotic, and destructive currents of cultural change.
For Steve, the only viable defense against societal and spiritual entropy is an inflexible, unyielding adherence to the original foundation. Any deviation, any loosening of the grip, is an invitation to collapse.
Which brings us back to the image of the house with the shifting foundation. Brother Steve's argument presents a compelling counter-narrative to the prevailing cultural ethos.
He argues that true freedom is not found in the modern pursuit of doing whatever we want, but rather in strict, unwavering obedience to a higher law.
It is a worldview that demands absolute conformity to an objective standard, rejecting the modern premise that the individual is the ultimate arbiter of truth.
But understanding his argument leaves us with a deeply philosophical question to ponder.
Yes. As we conclude today's exploration, consider this. Steve argues that the only way to save the house is by adhering strictly to a single divine blueprint. But we live in a highly pluralistic, globalized world where different groups hold completely different, deeply entrenched definitions of what that higher law actually is.
Right.
If society cannot agree on which blueprint to use, how do we build a cohesive civilization without everyone simply reverting to doing what is right in their own eyes? When the foundation of shared reality fractures, how do we keep the house from falling apart?
That is the defining question for a society trying to balance individual liberty with collective order.
Thank you for joining us on this deep dive into the forces shaping our cultural and theological landscapes. Keep asking the hard questions, and we will catch you next time.